Well, you were telling me about how the book got its title, and apparently came from some very famous artist. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, I went to see Picasso, and he told me, the passions in life change, but it is your work that is the ultimate seduction. I asked him what the first thought or memory or impression he had was. He said the first thing he ever thought about was little girls. It's a very little boy. That's what he was interested in. And I said, what was your second thought or impression? He said, same thing. And he said, as a little boy, he drew pictures. And little girls came and stood next to him, and they leaned against him. And they admired what he did, and he liked it all, so he went on drawing. And then as a teenager, he would stand there drawing his pictures. And then when the girls stood close to him, he liked it even more. And he got more girls and better girls, and the girls said yes instead of no. So he thought being an artist was the best thing to be. But as he worked, the work took over, and it became everything, his whole life. And the only kind of girl he had time for was one who gave the whole priority to his work. And there weren't many of those. He said a few pretended. A few could do it in the beginning, but very few could go on doing it. And that's when he told me that it was his work in life that was the ultimate seduction.
Is that the ultimate link among all of the very famous people that you've interviewed, that they are all interwound, or they were all interwound with their work?
Yes, it is. I didn't know what the links would be when I began writing. And I found it as I talked to the people. Picasso was actually the first. But as I spoke with Fellini, Mae West, Groucho Marx, Tennessee Williams, Henry Moore, Chagall, Laurence Olivier, all of them went on to say the very same thing, that for them, and they were very lucky people because they had very special work, their work was the most important thing in their lives.
You developed a kind of a personal relationship with many of these people, didn't you?
Yes, I certainly did. Of those people I named, of course, Groucho played a tremendous part in my life because he was the subject of my first book, Hello, I Must Be Going. And he encouraged me to write this book. I was seeing some of these people during the time I knew him. And he said, you really should write a book about all of those people, but not until you write the one about me.
Well, had it entered your mind initially to take a journalistic approach to these people, or were your meetings accidental with these people, or what? How did it happen?
No, actually, they were planned meetings, except for one. I had one accidental meeting, and that was Tennessee Williams. He's the only person in the book I met without knowing who he was when I met him. And so I actually had the experience of spending 20 minutes, half an hour with him without knowing he was Tennessee Williams.
How did that happen?
It was at a cocktail party in New York, and he's the person you always hope you'll sit next to on the airplane or meet at a cocktail party. And one usually doesn't, but this time I did. And he was wonderful and interesting. And I didn't know who he was, but people in the room were looking at him, and I realized he was a celebrity, and I was hesitant to ask him his name because I thought maybe I should have recognized him. And then Douglas Fairbanks, Jr., who was at the party, came over, and he said to him, do you remember the night we were at the White House, Tennessee? And that's when I knew it was Tennessee Williams.
Parenthetically, Robert Ludlum told me a wonderful story. Robert Ludlum is a writer of thrillers, mysteries.
Yes, I know indeed.
Do you know him personally?
I don't know him personally, but I know his
well,
work.
Well, if you've ever seen him, there is an uncanny resemblance between Robert Ludlum and William Holden. They sound alike, they look alike, and at any rate, Ludlum was on an airplane once, and he was sitting next to William Holden, and they were both having cocktails in the airplane, and Holden leans over to Robert Ludlum and says, say, haven't I seen you somewhere before?
That's wonderful. William Holden is someone I spoke with briefly for this book, and he talked with me about the difficulty of being William Holden. He said to me, you really should have Billy Wilder here. He wrote those lines for me. He thought it was a tremendous burden having to live up to the image of the characters on the screen, something I call in the book the extended self, the way people think you'll be based on the characters you play or your work.
Now, you said a moment ago that each of your meetings with the celebrities had been planned. Did you go knowing what you were going to do, what you had in mind?
Well, with Groucho, I wanted to interview him, but I didn't think I was going to get it because he'd always turned down the possibilities of doing interviews. I was going to do it for Playboy magazine, and I called him and asked him if he would do it with me. And he said that he didn't do that kind of thing. He just told Life magazine he wouldn't do it with them for $10,000. And he said he wouldn't have done it with them for $20,000, and he wouldn't do it with me for $30,000. And then he invited me to come over so he could tell me no in person. And that was the interview that I did with him. I went right over. And it did grow into an interview for the magazine, and that became the book.
So that was
how I met him.
I believe you quote Groucho in the book as saying, I never work cheap, but I will work free.
Mm-hmm. That was how he felt. He would do charity things. But if he did something for money, he had to have his full price. And then, of course, Mae West was pre-planned. It was the director, George Cukor, who arranged it with her. And she agreed to do it because even though she was almost 90, she still had high hopes that George Cukor, who was still alive, would direct her in a film because he was the great woman's director and the only director she'd ever dreamed of having whom she hadn't had. And so for that reason, she agreed to see me, even though she told him that women were a waste of time and she didn't like seeing a woman. And when I went to see her, she took pity on me. I held out my hand and took her hand, and she scratched the palm of my hand with her diamonds. She had diamond rings on every finger. And then she looked at my hand where I'd scratched it and saw that I didn't have any diamonds. And she said, "You poor thing, you don't have any?" And then she said, "You must have left them at home." But when I admitted that I hadn't left them at home, she decided I needed a lot of help and that she could possibly give it to me, in spite of the fact that I was nearly a lost cause. And so our meetings after that were usually advice on how I could improve things and get diamonds. But then in a very touching moment, the last time I ever saw her, she called me back just as I was leaving and said she wanted to tell me something, and that was that she'd bought some of the diamonds herself. They weren't all gifts.
Did you take a tape recorder with you?
I did. I always had a tape recorder, and I used it whenever I could, which is most of the time. Sometimes I would be at an occasion with someone where I couldn't, or occasionally someone wouldn't like the tape recorder. But whenever I could, I used it.
Tell me a little bit about Alfred Hitchcock. Last year, Donald Soto, Spoto, I guess his name was, wrote a biography of Hitchcock, which was not at all flattering. I don't know if you... Did you read that?
I didn't read it, but I know the idea of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always had a very good time with Alfred Hitchcock. He was not a totally happy person. He always said he wanted to be Cary Grant, and he really meant it. He said no one would want to be typecast in life looking like Alfred Hitchcock. But he really loved what he did. He was an example of a person, he said, who turned a disadvantage into an advantage. And that was being a lonely child and a homely child and someone who didn't have playmates and friends. He lived in his world of imagination. And that's how he felt he developed his style, which was creating the film in his head and actually seeing the whole thing from beginning to end, because he made up that kind of story as a lonely child. And it was kind of like what Golda Meir told me. She said that she wanted to be a pretty girl, a beautiful woman, but that actually she'd come to be grateful that she hadn't been, because she realized in her teens she wasn't going to be. And if she had been, maybe she would have coasted on that and not had anything else. And that knowing she was going to be a plain person meant she had to develop all the inner resources.
You mentioned Golda Meir, and of course there's Juan Perón here, and it looks to me as though the vast majority of people have no political affiliation at all. Very few people like that, world leaders such as Perón.
No, the emphasis is on the arts, but I did have a very unusual experience with Perón. He's someone I met by giving him a letter. I was in Madrid, and I thought it would be interesting to talk with him. So, not knowing his address, I wrote a letter to him, and I took the letter to his house. I found it by asking a cab driver to take me to Perón's house, and in Madrid, everyone knew where Perón lived. So when I got there, I was lucky, and lucky is a good thing to be. It's very important in everything. He was standing there in the gate playing with his poodles, and there were the sentries because it was the time of Franco, and he was a person in exile in Spain. I gave him my note. He read it, and he said he couldn't do an interview with me because it was against the conditions of his exile. But he said he would invite me in to have tea if I wanted to come in. And I was going to keep my taxi cab because I didn't want him to think I'd come to spend the rest of my life there. But he said it was a waste of money, paid the cab driver, and said he and his wife, Isabelita, would drive me in when they were going to Madrid to dinner. But that was 11 o'clock at night when they drove me back, and it was about 4 in the afternoon when we began having tea. And I did record these extensive interviews with him, but the really striking time was the last time I saw him before his return to Argentina. He told me to come over. It was a very special time, and I had to come at exactly that time. I did, and the tea party was with the body of Eva Perón, who had been brought from Italy, where she'd been almost 20 years after she died. She'd been kept there, but very carefully preserved and embalmed. And her embalmer was there in the house in Madrid. He was all in black, and he was combing her hair. And as he would comb her hair, these little clumps of blonde hair would fall onto the shiny parquet floor. And all the while, Isabelita Perón would be serving from the silver teapot, and there were cookies and cakes and petit four. And Perón would say I should have some mate because I wasn't eating enough, and it was an herb tea that would stimulate my appetite. But that was one of the more bizarre experiences.
Sounds more like a tea party out of Lewis Carroll
than
anything else. Some of these interviews go way back. Have you been sitting on them for a long time, or did you have them published in magazines?
No, nothing here has ever been published before. But I actually began seeing the people about the same time I began writing my first book, which is around 1974. And while I was seeing Groucho, I also, I'd been in to see Picasso just before that. Then I went to see Chagall during the time I knew Groucho, when I first was writing the interview with him. And that was interesting because Groucho loved to draw, and he'd always wanted to be an artist, and he painted one painting in his whole life. He didn't do it till he was 79. And the first painting he did, he liked so much that he said, I'll never be able to do better. So he retired as an artist and framed this picture, which was a whimsical little Hansel and Gretel type drawing, and he put it on the wall. And Jack Nicholson and Bill Cosby and Billy Wilder and George Burns would come over and they'd say, Grouch, what is it? And he would say he didn't explain his art or humor or talk about sex or romance or those things go away. But he was really proud of this picture, and everybody would say, it looks like Chagall. So when I went to see Chagall, I took a picture of the picture and showed it to Chagall, who studied it for about a minute and then looked up and said, it's very Chagall. And so I had him write it on the picture and took it back to Groucho. But I began seeing the people during that time. And then it went through all the way till the very last people I saw just before I finished the book. And I didn't know at the time what the themes would be, but the book is organized into the idea of the drive that impelled the people to go where they were going, and then the way there, what they found along the way, what helped them, what they learned, what they needed to accomplish what they wanted, what they had to share, and their observations on it. And then the last part is on happiness. Is there really there? And the section gets its title from what Tennessee Williams told me about his life. He said, no one who knew my day-to-day life would envy me. And all of these people believed that in looking for success, they were going to find happiness. Happiness is what they wanted. But it didn't always equal that. And they felt happiness was going to be an escape from loneliness. But success didn't mean that.
Did you use a cassette recorder for most of the conversation?
Yes.
So what happened when you, as you began compiling these tapes, you say you didn't know how you would use them exactly, I guess, and this you must have done this over a long period of time. So what happened? Did you sit down and make transcripts?
Hundreds and hundreds of cassettes and maybe thousands of hours of the people speaking. Because some of the people I knew well who were in the book, people like Rennie Clare and Jacques Tati, who may appear for only moments, people who say just a few things to me, King Vidor, George Cukor, who aren't major people in the book. And yet I knew them over a long period of time, over several years, and spent many hours with them. So it was a tremendous job of transcribing tapes.
Let me ask you something about yourself. First of all, why all this interest in all these celebrities?
I've always wanted to write. And so the writing has been fiction as well as nonfiction. And a lot of it involved travel and writing about places. But I've always had the interest in talking with people and doing the interviews. And then the first book, though I'd always meant to do a first book, I didn't know what it would be, grew out of Groucho's encouragement to turn the interview into a book. And at the time, I hesitated what must have been probably 30 seconds. But it is a big commitment to do a whole book, and a big commitment to do it with one person and around one person. and to spend that much time, although it was a perfect joy and I liked everything about it except that he died before I could give him the finished book. And then during that time, I was doing some interviews from time to time for Playboy. And I like the interview format. I like having the person speak for himself. I may write about it and have my own comments, but I do like their words appearing exactly as they spoke them, because I think that's what presents the picture of the person. And I had that experience myself, so I felt I wanted to share that.
Tell me a little bit about your background. Where are you from?
From California. I live in New York.
Where in California?
Northern California, near San Francisco.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school in California as a child, and I went to school in Europe.
Can you give us some specifics?
I went to school in Spain, in Madrid and Santander, and in London. And then I came back to the United States and planned to go back to California, but stayed in New York. I stopped in New York to spend a few weeks, which became a few months. And I go frequently to California, but I live in New York now.
Are you a member of the Chandler newspaper family?
No, I'm not. Nor related to Raymond Chandler. I'm asked that, too.
Uh-huh. What did your parents do?
Nothing related to writing or show business.
You sound like an extremely private person who is more interested in many of the celebrities than talking about yourself.
I think it's more interesting because I try to choose people of really legendary achievement. And even in selecting the people, they're not just celebrities, but they're people with long careers of accomplishment. So that I didn't want to have people who were just lottery winners. For instance, one of the least known people in the book is Vladimir Zworykin, who invented the iconoscope and kinescope that made television possible. But with all of the people, though many of them are entertainers, people like Mae West and Groucho Marx created their own characters and did much of their own writing and brought so much entertainment to people over such a long time that their achievement was, for me, greater than just being a movie star, a television personality for a year or two. So most of the people are older in the book because they had these long careers. Woody Allen's one of the youngest.
Well, it's a wonderful book, Charlotte Chandler, and you've given us a lot of insights about many of these people, and I think it's quite interesting that you were able to collect all these people. Oh, you're just a people collector. Are you still collecting people?
I'd like to. I hope to spend the rest of my life meeting people as interesting as these.
Can you tell me some of the people you're collecting right now?
Actually, the interviews and conversations are in reverse now, because, as you said, I really felt like a private person who never expected to do radio or television or give newspaper interviews. When I wrote my first book, I thought Groucho would do all of that. And then I found out that if you want to help a book in life, that they don't just run out of the bookstores on little legs of their own, and you have to try to give them something in life because it's very difficult. So I began doing it, and I found that I had a very good time, and I met a lot of people, but it was like it was the interview in reverse. It was the conversation, but suddenly I was the person being called on to speak more.
And yet, not about yourself as such. For example, I could see some hesitancy when I ask you some personal questions about where you're from, and the lack of being specific. I think that you appear to be one who would rather take step aside a little bit and let the people that you've interviewed speak for themselves.
The picture on the cover is a drawing of the back of my head, which was done by Leroy Neiman. And I suppose I liked it so much and wanted it as the cover because I think it really expressed the way I felt about it, that I am present for the interviews and the conversations, and what happened wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been there, but that I really wanted the other people to have forefront.
Well, I certainly enjoyed the book, Charlotte Chandler, and I thank you very much for coming in, and wish you the best of luck on your upcoming tour.
Thank you very much.